Welcome to my half-hour theme-based show, Poems for Company. I'm your host, Brian Dillon, and this episode's title is One Word. Each of today's poems puzzle over an individual word. They reflect on the various uses of the individual word. Implicitly, the poets featured on today's show urge us to consider how strange our language is when we examine it up close. Leonard Cohen, the grandson of a rabbi, grew up in a Jewish community in Montreal, yet he became a Buddhist practitioner as an adult. That led to Cohen being labeled a Jubu, J-U-B-U, one who blends Judaism with Buddhism. The title song of the last CD he released before he died in 2016, when Cohen knew his health was rapidly declining, is You Want It Darker. The opening verse reads, "If you are the dealer, I'm out of the game. If you are the healer, it means I'm broken and lame. If thine is the glory, then mine must be the shame. You want it darker, we kill the flame." The two-line chorus to Cohen's You Want It Darker says, "Hineni, hineni, I'm ready, my Lord." The Hebrew word hineni can be translated as, "Here I am." When Abraham hears the divine voice, he responds with, "Hineni, here I am." Then he dutifully travels for 3 days with his son Isaac, whom the divine voice says must be sacrificed. When Moses sees the burning bush, he hears a divine voice calling out to him, and Moses responds, "Hineni." This voice makes an extraordinary demand upon him: "Lead the chosen ones, millions of Israelites, out of Egypt to the promised land." The word "Hineni" implies both Abraham and Moses are willing to cross a threshold, step into a life-changing moment by their inexplicable obedience to follow the directions of the divine. And they don't know what the outcome will be for their willingness to serve. The "you" in Leonard Cohen's "You Want It Darker" certainly seems to refer to a higher partner, a higher power. "Hineni, I'm ready, my Lord." But what does Cohen suggest he's ready for? To die? And if so, does he expect to be punished? Rewarded? The one word "hineni" carries so much weight in this song. Essentially, "hineni" means, "I'm your inferior, your subject. I'm here to do your bidding." He's willing to be obedient when the most mysterious of all moments arrive. Leonard Cohen does coat this song's lyrics with a layer of seriousness by relying upon this Hebrew term, "hineni." He uses the term at least 8 times. He highlights the power of a single word in one poem. Okay, fair enough. He expresses humility while he also anticipates his own demise. But we must remember, this is Leonard Cohen. So he also includes some self-mocking lines. He says, "I struggled with some demons. They were middle class and tame." Our next example opens with an epigraph, a quote at the top of the poem, a quote from a handbook about how to write fiction. Quotes, "Never use the word suddenly just to create tension." That sounds like very specific, valuable advice. The poem then appears to violate this advice by repeatedly using the word "suddenly." This is Billy Collins' poem, "Tension." "Suddenly, you were planting some yellow petunias outside in the garden, and suddenly I was in the study looking up the word oligarchy for the 37th time. when, suddenly, without warning, you planted the last petunia in the flat, and I suddenly closed the dictionary, now that I was reminded of that vile form of governance. A moment later, we found ourselves standing suddenly in the kitchen, where you suddenly opened a can of cat food, and I, just as suddenly, watched you doing that. I observed a window of leafy activity, and beyond that, a bird perched on the edge of the stone birdbath, when suddenly you announced you were leaving to pick up a few things at the market, and I stunned you by impulsively pointing out that we were getting low on butter, and another case of wine would not be a bad idea. Who could tell what the next moment would hold? Another drip from the faucet? Another little spasm of the second hand? Would the painting of a bowl of pears continue to hang on the wall from that nail? Would the heavy anthologies remain on their shelves? Would the stove hold its position? Suddenly, it was anyone's guess. The sun rose ever higher in the sky. The state capitals remained motionless on the wall map, when suddenly I found myself lying on a couch, where I closed my eyes and, without any warning, began to picture the Andes, of all places, and a path that led over the mountains to another country with strange customs and eye-catching hats, each one suddenly fringed with colorful little tassels. Recall the epigraph for Billy Collins' poem, Tensions, is from a book titled Writing Fiction, which asserts, never use the word suddenly just to create tension. The 11 uses of the term suddenly reinforce this guidebook's advice by using the term suddenly in ridiculous ways. Does anyone suddenly find themselves lying on a couch? Does anyone ever suddenly open a can of cat food? Billy Collins magnifies the ridiculousness of the so-called sudden circumstance by titling the poem Tension. I realize I run the risk of draining the poem of its humor by emphasizing the obvious. The actions of this couple are as banal as those of most couples who settled into their habits long ago. The partner announces she's off to the market, and the speaker stuns her by impulsively pointing out that we were getting low on butter. No dangers, no risks, no tensions exist for this couple. Again, this is Billy Collins' Tension. Suddenly, you were planting some yellow petunias outside in the garden, and suddenly, I was in the study, looking up the word oligarchy for the 37th time, when suddenly, without warning, you planted the last petunia in the flat, and I suddenly closed the dictionary, now that I was reminded of that vile form of governance. A moment later, we found ourselves standing suddenly in the kitchen, where you suddenly opened a can of cat food, and I, just as suddenly, watched you doing that. I observed a window of leafy activity, and beyond that, a bird perched on the edge of the stone birdbath, when suddenly you announced you were leaving to pick up a few things at the market, and I stunned you by impulsively pointing out that we were getting low on butter, and another case of wine would not be a bad idea. Who could tell what the next moment would hold? Another drip from the faucet? Another little spasm of the second hand? Would the painting of a bowl of pears continue to hang on the wall from that nail? Would the heavy anthologies remain on their shelves? Would the stove hold its position? Suddenly it was anyone's guess. The sun rose ever higher in the sky. The state capitals remained motionless on the wall map, when suddenly I found myself lying on a couch where I closed my eyes and without any warning began to picture the Andes, of all places, and the path that led over the mountains to another country, with strange customs and eye-catching hats, each one suddenly fringed with colorful little tassels. The serious-sounding tone of Billy Collins' tension is maintained for all 9 verses. Never does the speaker even hint that maybe his terminology is horribly inappropriate. That certainty that suddenly is the right term for these events shapes the poem. That certainty that these events created tension also shapes the poem. The speaker wonders who could tell what the next moment would hold, then answers this query with 5 more questions, including a concern whether his books would remain on his shelf and other nonsensical fears. It's wonderfully ludicrous. Now, every time I see the word suddenly in a novel, I question, is this necessary? Does it add genuine tension to the narrative events? I will return to another contemporary poem in just a few minutes, but first, let's go back in time to the Grand Master. Let's remember, a typical sonnet is 14 lines. In his sonnet number 135, Will Shakespeare uses the term will 13 times and the term wilt 1 time. I wish you could see the text of the poem. Sometimes Shakespeare relies on an uppercase W for will. Sometimes the word is in italics. It seems safe to presume there's some autobiographical dimension to this poem, that will at times refers to the speaker, the poet, the man from Stratford himself. There are 154 sonnets in Shakespeare's sonnet sequence, and this is number 135, fairly late in the sequence. By this point, the obsession with the young androgynous man has been explored in many earlier sonnets, and now Will is focused on the so-called Dark Lady, to whom the sonnet seems addressed. Let's hear the sonnet, reflect on it, and then hear it again. This is Shakespeare's sonnet number 135. Whoever hath her wish, thou hast thy will, and will to boot, and will in overplus. More than enough am I that vex thee still, to thy sweet will making addition thus. Wilt thou, whose will is large and spacious, not once vouchsafe to hide my will in thine? Shall will in others seem right gracious, and in my will no fair acceptance shine? The sea, all water, yet receives rain still, and in abundance addeth to his store. So, thou being rich in will, add to thy will one will of mine to make thy large will more. Let no unkind, no fair beseechers kill. Think all but one, and me in that one will. In terms of the overall plot of the sonnet sequence, this one, number 135, suggests the Dark Lady, this totally anonymous creature of desire, has at least one other lover. The speaker of the poem, Will, does not demand that she banish another lover or any other man, but that she also admit the speaker, Will, too, to the realm of her carnal desires. I'm trying to phrase this accurately as well as respectfully. The term will is fluid. One meaning is sexual desires. The speaker presumes the woman he addresses is already sexually satisfied. As the first two lines state, whoever hath her wish, thou hast thy will, and will to boot, and will in overplus. Yet, self-consciously the speaker declares, more than enough am I that vex thee still. The speaker, who we may imagine is Shakespeare himself, recognizes that his wooing of this so-called dark lady, his vexing of her, is not welcome. But please, he urges, to thy sweet will make addition thus. To put it bluntly, allow me to share your bed too. He does not intend to banish his rivals. He wants to coexist with them. He's comfortable being one of a number of lovers as long as he achieves sexual satisfaction. Let's catch our breath here. Yes, this is a bawdy poem. The term will also refers to sexual organs. The speaker projects onto his object of desire a nearly insatiable carnal appetite. Her will is large and spacious, so she should consent or vouchsafe to hide his will in thine, which is about as blunt as a sexual entendre might be. The sonnet also absorbs biblical language to reinforce his point, language from the opening chapter of Ecclesiastes. Quotes, all streams run to the sea, yet the sea never overflows. Back to the place from which the streams ran, they return to run again. Shakespeare's speaker applies this passage to his certainty that the woman he desires is like the sea, in that she may absorb various men, including the speaker, without any harm done to anyone. The sea never overflows. In the sonnet's final couplet, he urges, let no unkind, no fair beseechers kill. That is, don't turn away any of your lovers. Don't kill them with unkindness. Again, Sonnet 135. Whoever hath her wish, thou hast thy will, and will to boot, and will in overplus. More than enough am I that vex thee still, to thy sweet will making addition thus. Wilt thou, whose will is large and spacious, not once vouchsafe to hide my will in thine? Shall will in others seem right gracious, and in my will no fair acceptance shine? The sea, all water yet receives rain still, and in abundance addeth to his store. So, thou being rich in will, add to thy will one will of mine to make thy large will more. Let no unkind, no fair beseechers kill. Think all but one, and me in that one will. We do not hear the reply of the dark lady to this speaker's pleading. We are left to imagine how she receives his argument, so carefully phrased, so intent on playing with his own provocative name. Now back to a contemporary poem in which the speaker indicates he brought home from his travels a familiar word used in various ways that were novel to him. The poem's title, Love Thee, and under the title were tipped off, quotes, Edinburgh, November 2013. The speaker certainly does not overdo his use of the title term. It appears only twice in the poem itself, but its use is implied throughout the poem. This is Robert Wrigley's Lovely. Edinburgh, November 2013. Three train conductors pronounced our tickets so. Two waiters approved of our orders in their pubs. And a clerk, when my wife, befuddled by the coinage, held out a palm full of pounds and pence, counted aloud 1, 3, 4 quid 10, and declared that amount, or the sweetness of her, or the blueness of her eyes, just the same. And the stranger who took the park bench beside us one night in Newcastle, who smoked 3 cigarettes as we sipped our champagne and whiskey, who told us half her life story and was told by us half of ours, said lovely 11 times, or maybe 12. I might have missed one, and now I miss them all. You don't hear it much back home, except lately around our house, the view from which has often been described as beautiful, majestic, awesome, or amazing, but hardly ever, as it seems this afternoon, lovely. The sun going down, and tomorrow, even now, arriving right on time, midnight, 2400 GMT, over there. Roughly the time that night in Scotland when we sat on a hotel towel under our umbrellas on Lady Stairs Close, and a man nodded to us as he climbed toward High Street and said it mysteriously. An evaluation of the night, or of our chosen perch, or simply of us, or rather, as it seemed it was, merely as a greeting, so much better, so vastly superior to hello. Some numbers. 28 lines in the poem, 4 sentences, the first consisting of 7 lines, the next 5.5, then a 1-line sentence, and Wrigley brings it home with a sentence that spills out over the final 14.5 lines. When the count breaks down that way, the 1-line sentence stands out, calls for our attention. After he comments on the woman on the park bench in Newcastle, who engages the speaker and his wife in conversation, he notes she used the title term 11 times, or maybe 12, then offers this unique 1-line appraisal. I might have missed one, and now I miss them all. The straightforwardness of the poem is itself lovely. Only small features might give a reader pause, but they certainly would not block us from appreciating this poem. We can easily suss out that 2400 GMT refers to midnight, Greenwich Mean Time, a reference prompted by the poet's thought of what time it would be in Scotland as he looks out the window from his home in the western United States. And, relaxing from their Edinburgh rambles, the speaker and his wife sit on a hotel towel under their umbrellas on Lady Stairs Close. That's a narrow passageway adjacent to a townhouse once lived in by the Countess of Stair, Scotland. The Countess's former house is now the site of a writer's museum in Edinburgh. Let's hear the poem again. Robert Wrigley's Lovely. Edinburgh, November 2013. 3 train conductors pronounced our tickets so. 2 waiters approved of our orders in their pubs. And a clerk, when my wife, befuddled by the coinage, held out a palm full of pounds and pence, counted aloud 1, 3, 4 quid 10, and declared that amount, or the sweetness of her, or the blueness of her eyes, just the same. And the stranger who took the park bench beside us one night in Newcastle, who smoked 3 cigarettes as we sipped our champagne and whiskey, who told us half her life story and was told by us half of ours, said lovely 11 times, or maybe 12. I might have missed one, and now I miss them all. You don't hear it much back home, except lately around our house, the view from which has often been described as beautiful, majestic, awesome, or amazing, but hardly ever, as it seems this afternoon, lovely. The sun going down, and tomorrow even now arriving right on time, midnight 2400 GMT over there, roughly the time that night in Scotland when we sat on a hotel towel under our umbrellas on Lady Stairs Close, and a man nodded to us as he climbed toward High Street and said it mysteriously. An evaluation of the night, or of our chosen perch, or simply of us, or rather, as it seemed it was, merely as a greeting, so much better, so vastly superior to hello. Robert Wrigley's Lovely. What's in a word? Leonard Cohen's Hineni. Billy Collins's Suddenly. Will Shakespeare's Will. And Robert Wrigley's Lovely. All these poems are identified again at the KMUN.org website under podcast. And this and all other episodes of Poems for Company may be accessed there, as well as on numerous other apps. Our theme music is Philip Ahlberg's Going to the Sun from a CD, Live from Montana, available at sweetgrassmusic.com. Thanks for listening to Poems for Company.